How is the climate conversation changing in the wake of the COVID pandemic? Climate One Conversations feature oil companies and environmentalists, Republicans and Democrats, the exciting and the scary aspects of the climate challenge. I'm Greg Dalton. It's been fascinating recently to compare how people are responding to two invisible threats, the coronavirus and carbon pollution. One threat is personal, direct, and close. Touch an infected surface or talk too close to someone, and you could be deathly sick in a matter of days. The other is impersonal, indirect, and far away. Driving your car contributes in some tiny way to future melting glaciers, rising seas, and scorching heat waves. In upcoming episodes, we're going to explore the health, economic, political, and other dimensions of these two crises. Today, we're focusing on the human and behavioral responses. Addressing COVID-19 and climate both require individuals to think beyond themselves.
What's expeditious for an individual to do is often just a horrible thing for the community if people do it.
Robert H. Frank is professor of economics at Cornell University's Johnson Graduate School of Management. He's a former columnist with the New York Times and author of Under the Influence, Putting Peer Pressure to Work. The coronavirus pandemic has changed the conversation about everything, including climate.
Even just a few months ago, you saw this extraordinary energy around climate change that I'm worrying now has been evaporated because we've gone from an us everywhere forever mindset to a me here now mindset.
Peter Atwater is adjunct economics professor at the College of William and Mary. He studies confidence-driven decision-making and trends in his Financial Insights newsletter. Our reactions to some emergencies may be as much about what we learn as how we learn about them.
We don't have a lot of people who are very prominent talking about how scary climate change is, but we do have a lot of people talking about how scary COVID-19 is.
Susan Clayton is professor of psychology at the College of Worcester, where she's also chair of environmental studies. She co-authored the American Psychological Association report on psychology and global climate change. All three guests recently joined me from the safety of their homes to explore the human reaction to pandemics and other invisible threats, starting with a tickle in Susan's throat in the middle of the night.
I overreacted. I thought, oh no, I have the coronavirus. I'm doomed, essentially. And it took just a second or two for my rational mind to kick in and tell me that that was very unlikely. But it's that instinctive reaction that I think explains a lot of the kind of reaction we see among other people as well.
And how does that, the reaction to this virus, which is invisible, how do you see that compared to this gas, carbon pollution, which is also invisible and deadly and harmful in a different way? How do you compare those two, our human responses?
Yeah, well, clearly we're responding a lot more strongly to the coronavirus than to climate change. And part of the reason for that is I think disease is a lot more immediate, a lot more scary than the idea that we're gradually destroying or harming the atmosphere and the ecosystem. So we definitely respond to that idea that our personal health is compromised. But I also think it's important to recognize that both of these things, because they are invisible, people are kind of relying on, they need to have the situation interpreted for them. So there's a really big role for the social media, for, you know, political figures and other people who are prominent and visible to explain to them. In one case, we don't have a lot of people who are very prominent talking about how scary climate change is, but we do have a lot of people talking about how scary COVID-19 is.
And we'll get to the social media in a minute. Peter Atwater, you liken this moment where that we have this looming threat, that you liken it to when Hurricane Katrina was barreling down on the Gulf Coast and there's this big scary thing offshore. It's coming. We can kind of watch it coming our way. How do you compare that Katrina moment to what we've been watching, experiencing with COVID-19?
So what you could see was that, particularly from an American perspective, when the virus was contained in China, that was the first narrative that went along with that. There you had an existential threat that was far, far away and really, really not a threat with the view that it was contained. And what I could watch and see was the narratives brought it closer and closer to us in terms of proximity. And one of the things about threats is that our anxiety rises exponentially as threats become closer and closer to us from a perception standpoint. And so you could see the level of anxiety turn to panic as it went from being afar and contained to being near us to now being among us.
Right. I mean, I was a reporter in China in the 1980s and studied China and I've heard of pandemics, but at no point when I read about Wuhan did I anticipate that it would come here and have the impact. And I think maybe I'm ignorant of the science and some people might feel that way about climate change. Robert Frank, how do you see the way individuals are responding to these distant threats and very different invisible threats?
Well, I think Susan hit it on the head with the distinction between what seems like a distant threat on the one hand, that's the way many people view the climate threat, and the virus threat, which is really quite immediate. I mean, you have 2 weeks from the time you're exposed to it to the moment you might be faced with a genuine threat to your life. And what we know is that people are just not very good at reckoning how to deal with threats that seem distant many years into the future. There's some interesting work by an economist at UCLA, Hal Hirschfeld. He shows people pictures of themselves that are digitally altered to simulate what they would look like at age 80 or so. And after having had a chance to study the image of yourself at age 80, people become much more future-oriented in little experiments that he asks them to make choices between now and later. People are much more future-oriented. So I think it's what Pigou called the faulty telescopic faculty. We can't look ahead and put adequate weight on the future. What's changed in recent years, fortunately, is that the extremity of weather events, the fires, the droughts, the floods, have persuaded many people that climate crisis is not a distant phenomenon at all. It's really upon us. And so I think many more people are willing to take seriously the fact that we need to take action to try to parry the threat that compared to 3 or 4 years ago, it's a much bigger change than I think I saw coming.
So there's a important differences on time and proximity. You know, someone, a gunshot somewhere in a city is one thing, but a gunshot on your block gets your attention a lot more dramatically. Susan Clayton, what's about the importance of actually seeing? You know, we hear information, we read, but, you know, we live in a very visual age, particularly video, social media. How important is it, you know, to see someone? I watched 60 Minutes, someone being, you know, carried into a hospital in one of those cocoons. Is like how important is seeing versus other forms, ways of processing information?
Well, I think, you know, Robert hit the nail on the head when he talked about how some things seem very distant and other things begin to seem very close to us. And time scale is one of the things that can make them seem distant or not. And a visual display can also bring it home and make it much more personal. It's not the only way for people to feel that something is close, but it is something that tends to have an impact. We're a very visual species, and even a little bit of visual information entering your field of vision will grab your attention. So when we see a striking image, it tends to have a major impact.
Journalist Shannon Osaka covers climate change for Grist. She recently wrote an article detailing how the spread of zoonotic animal-borne diseases like the coronavirus have been aided by a warming climate and the destruction of animals' natural habitat.
In the decade of the 1950s, about 30 new infectious diseases were reported. And in the 1980s, the number jumped to almost 100. And scientists think that a big part of this is based on how our relationship has changed with the natural world. Our encroachment on wildlife has just dramatically increased. We have deforested large portions of the planet. Our urbanization is impinging on habitats that we used to pretty much leave alone. And a lot of infectious diseases that we think about as being a big deal today, so that includes SARS, MERS, Middle East Respiratory Syndrome, and now the coronavirus, they often originate from bats. And as we encroach on sort of wildlife and habitats, we see those bats basically coming more into contact with humans, more into contact with other wildlife that might contact humans. And all of that means that the possibility of a virus traveling from bats to humans goes way up. There was a study in 2017 about Ebola outbreaks, and Ebola has also been linked to bats. And this study found that areas of Central and West Africa, which had recently been deforested, had a higher incidence of Ebola outbreaks. And there's a lot of scientists who have been out there kind of sounding the alarm and saying, look, we know that when we are deforesting, when we're doing habitat destruction, but also warming temperatures causes animals to move from their traditional areas. And so that can mean animals coming more into contact with humans, and it can also mean animals coming into contact with other animals, and that can also cause other forms of spillover. What we're seeing now is really not the worst thing that could happen. The coronavirus is not extraordinarily fatal. And so a lot of the experts I talked to said, you know, we should see this as kind of a shot over the bow. The natural world is kind of saying, hey, look, this is the kind of thing that can happen. And there is a possibility that future pandemics could be worse.
That was Grist magazine reporter Shannon Osaka. Peter Atwater, your reaction that this could be, things could be worse, and maybe there's some messages there that, about our relationship with nature.
Well, I think that, you know, when confidence starts to fall, we naturally fall into that cycle of things being worse. We're looking for, you know, conditions to deteriorate even further. It's something that, you know, we're magnetized either to overconfidence or to underconfidence. And right now, I think there's a, in any number of ways, I'm seeing lots of not just reassessment of risk, but potentially an overassessment of risks.
Are you saying we're overreacting?
No, I'm just saying that with confidence being lower than it has been, we are prone to overreact to things that we view as threats.
Robert Frank, there's a kind of a backlash now saying, you know, reopen America, we've gone too far. Do you think there's a reassessment of risk happening?
Well, we certainly know that there are some people among us who are not overreacting to the risk. I'm sure you, like the rest of us, saw those clips of the revelers in Florida last week. Why should I interrupt my long planned trip to for spring break just because there's a virus out there? I might get it, but so what? I'm young. I'm not going to suffer much from it. So I think there was a sort of a clear trail of people who were just not at all concerned or not nearly as concerned as they ought to have been about the risks, if not to themselves, at least to other people that even they care about, never mind the people that we all care about. So I think there's an upside to being too alarmed. There's a downside to being too alarmed. If you had to choose between those in the current moment, I'd say being too alarmed is probably the better choice.
You're listening to a Climate One conversation about responding to invisible threats. Coming up, looking for leadership in the midst of crisis.
I think this is a case where many people are recognizing that you do need to have government help, government advice, government regulations to really get through this.
That's up next when Climate One continues.